I'm going to be starting. I don't know how far I'm going to get, but I'm actually going to go through my little thing on marriage, but I want to start prior to that. When I taught this the last time was in 2011 to my class downstairs, and it is a part of, if you define education, education is all that series of discipline and instruction which is intended to enlighten the understanding, correct the temper, form manners and habits of youth, and to fit for usefulness in future stations. So that element, fitting for usefulness in future stations, is a part of education. So I went through this with the class back then. And as is true so often, I don't think they paid a whole lot of attention. We teach these things and people sit and listen to these things, and that's kind of where it goes. And in that book I just gave you, Jay Adams makes a point about that where he says if you're simply lecturing, especially in today's world, it's not like it was in the 1600s, 1700s, and so forth, where the lecture was the primary method, and that people were very, very attentive to the lecture, and they would go to church and receive the instruction in church, and then they would go home, and the fathers would instruct the family in what they had been instructed in. He would go back over it, and so you had a high rate of success. But today, because attention span is so little, Doug came over last night and he came in and he said, "Dad, I've got an idea for a business that you can go into." And so he sat down and explained to me about blogging for money and how you can use, this guy has this thing where he started a blog. Said it took him about a year and a half to build it up, but what the idea is, you start blogging with the idea of getting advertisers who you can put their advertisements on your page, and that's, I suppose, where the money comes from, is the advertisers. It's just like radio. If you're on the radio, you look for commercials, people to do commercials. So he talked to me about it last night, and I said, I got the site, and I said, well, I'll look at this. Though I honestly don't have a great push inside of me to do that, but that doesn't mean I won't. But I said to him, I said, Doug, I tend to write in paragraphs because attention span is not what it used to be. And people, in general, you can't give them a 2 or 3 page document because they won't read it. If you give them a single paragraph, you can capsulize and you can put the information into that paragraph in the hope that they can read that little bit. And that's what I send to the editor of the Tribune. I send paragraphs, which he never ever responds to and doesn't see fit to publish. So in education, if you're going to blog, which I don't, I know what that is, but I don't fully understand how it works or how you would work it in this. But I may pursue it, and it might be something. This guy claims he makes $9,000 a month off of his blog after a year and a half. All of the claimants, they claim. I don't know if they actually do that or not. But if you can make $9,000 a month writing a paragraph and people respond because they respond to it, I guess the idea is you publish and they write comments, then you get going on whatever the case might be. So education is a fundamental part of our existence, and this is a part of that education, fitting for usefulness in future stations. Now, in the beginning of this presentation, the first thing I do is I dwell for a brief time on the role of a pastor. Because pastors are essential to marriage. And a pastor is to speak as God's ambassador. That's It doesn't matter whether it's in a marriage setting or whether it's on a Sunday morning preaching or whether it's teaching a class or whether it's just sitting down having a conversation. As I sat with Doug last night, he opened several doors and I had opportunity to share things with him and to try to bring in some cases clarification and some cases enlightenment. But when we find ourselves in this position, first of all, we as pastors have got to take it as seriously as God intends it to be taken. So when you are in that position of instruction, in this case, we're instructing with regard to marriage, the pastor is the ambassador for God. He is God's representative. And he is going to give these people the law of God, basically. So as God's ambassador, he is to clearly give forth the law concerning any matter. Let me give you a little thing here that happened on Friday. I had a student on Friday who turned in four paces for testing today. Now this student, whenever they turn in a test and take the test, almost without exception, scores 100 on their tests. So I have had a suspicion for some time that maybe the testing is not being done honestly, because answers are always word perfect. And it's very rare that anybody answers every question word perfect. So what I did was I said, I'm going to give you the tests right now. And went over to the table, I gave the tests, and the score on the math pace was 2%. Yeah, the score on one of the others was, I think, around 16%. All four were failed. So I confronted this person and I said, I have had a suspicion for some time that you are not being honest in your testing. The response was, of course, a kind of an angry response, you know, I'm getting accused of something here. So I took advantage of it to instruct the class. I had the class that afternoon and I said, this person has made an accusation against me of making an accusation against them. And so I went through, how do you handle a suspicion as compared to an accusation? Both of them have to be rooted in evidence. So if there is evidence, if a pastor is going to be dealing with law, when he's dealing in a counseling situation, or he's dealing in an instructive situation, or he's dealing in whatever case, he is to be handling the law, and where you are dealing correctively, obviously you have to start with evidence. And you have to have evidence to have a suspicion. If there is no evidence, there is no suspicion. Now, evidence is in two categories. There is what is called direct evidence. Direct evidence is that which is clearly there. You see it, you hear it. You can't deny it. It actually exists. The person is doing, saying, or whatever it might be, something that is a clear violation of law. In circumstantial evidence, there is the appearance of violation. But maybe the appearance is exactly that. It is an appearance, and as you go into this, you don't find an actual violation. So you have to do examination. Well, this is a pastor who is going to be involved in counseling, because counseling is almost always disciplinary and corrective. Counseling sometimes is not, but most of the time it is that. Now, when we're dealing with marriage, and I had a chance to think about this more perfectly as I was going through this, if you perform a wedding, if you accept the responsibility to perform a wedding, and if the couple who are getting married accept you as the person performing the wedding, and especially if you go through the marriage class with them or a marriage class with them or some kind of instructive procedure, what you are doing is you are setting yourself up in the position of A, instruction, and B, judgment. Because I explained this in the marriage class, that the reason you have a maid of honor, a matron of honor, or whatever, and a best man, or whatever, the reason you have two witnesses is because the two witnesses are obligated to hear the vows that are exchanged. And in the event of a marital problem, those people come back and they say, now, wait a minute. I stood there and listened to you take this vow. Now, if they are in violation of their vow, they are now to come under some form of discipline. And this is where the pastor, who is in the position of judgment as an elder in the church, and the session of the church, this is where they get involved eventually if proper procedure doesn't work. So the pastor is the ambassador, first of all. Secondly, he is to act as God's under-shepherd. He is a shepherd under Christ. So it is the idea, and the reason I do the class is because it is the obligation of the under-shepherd to lead the people into good pastures and beside still water if possible. So what you try to do is instruct in what is the behavior that will produce the greatest blessing, and what is the behavior that will produce the cursing? Because you're dealing with covenant here, you're always dealing with blessing and cursing. So the pastor in the beginning, the pastor occupies this office, and as an under shepherd, he is to be instructing the flock concerning that which will bring them the greatest nourishment. Peter said, shepherd the flock of God among you, exercising oversight. Oversight is a key word here, not by compulsion, but willingly, nor eagerly for base gain, but readily. In other words, you're not doing this to try to make money. You're doing this as a servant of the Lord who is trying to teach people so that they come into the blessing of God. Thirdly, in that position, he is to act as God's watchman. So in Ezekiel, he said, Son of man, the third chapter, 17th verse, he said, Son of man, I have made you a watchman for the house of Israel. Whenever you hear a word from my mouth, you shall give it to them. You shall give them warning. So it is in the case of Jim and I in this church, what he does in his method is to seek out the word of God so that when he comes up here at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning and begins to administer the word, he has sought out the word, and now he's going to give that to the flock. It's my obligation to do that also, whether it's Sunday morning, whether it's Wednesday night, or whether it's in school every day, or again, whether it's just in private conversation. You are going to seek out the word, and you're going to minister the word to people. So as God's watchman, up front, beforehand, you point out foreseeable dangers. What are the dangers here? You're going to enter into this covenant, and being as you're both human beings, it means that you are cursed, if I put it in quotes, you are cursed with depravity. And this person has the inability in their salvation matter to do anything. And so there is a sin nature. So you're looking at this and you're saying, okay, what are the dangers? Well, the dangers are the operation of the sin nature, which are expressed in Galatians 5 when he said, here's the works of the flesh. So you understand that is there, and you point that out as best as you can. And in my case, I do a questionnaire. And they go through a questionnaire, and they answer these questions for themselves and the other person. They don't just answer for themselves. So the questionnaire is designed to say, what is true of me, and what am I seeing in the other person? Now, when the other person answers the questionnaire, if they are honest, when they put down their weaknesses and their strengths and things of this nature, you may have you may have the girl seeing the guy in an entirely different light than he presents himself in the questionnaire. Or vice versa. You may have the guy seeing the girl in an entirely different light than their answers point out in the questionnaire. So as the watchman, what you do is you take the questionnaire, you compare the answers, and then in a confrontational mode in the class, not a mean confrontational mode, but in simply pointing out, you say, as an illustration, let's say that the question is simply this: are you a moody person? And one of them says of themselves, yes, I am, and of the other person, no, he or she is not. The other person answers it exactly the same way: yes, I am, no, he or she is not. Now you take those two answers and you say, do you know what? Both of you are moody people, but neither of you are seeing it in the other one, which means there is not an honest representation of who you are to each other. And since moodiness, which is usually a mark of immaturity, that a person is easily moved to anger or self-pity or whatever by a difficult thing, or goes to extreme highs and things that seem good, has not been noticed. And so the under-shepherd, who is acting here as a watchman, tries to point these things out so that the two people who are sitting there hear these various things before we even get into the study of marriage itself, and have the opportunity to say, you know, okay, that's there, but I'm willing to accept that. Or to say, you know what, I didn't know that. I don't think I want to take a chance on that. That can give me some difficulty. So the pastor is extremely important, or because normally if they go to a judge, the judge will do the ceremony, but he doesn't do any instruction. There are some that I have learned about over the years who do instruction. Or if they go to a pastor who does not do any instruction, they don't get the full ministry as God intended the pastor to perform, which indicates he is not really a pastor. He is probably a business manager who is running the church as a business for the denomination, or maybe for himself. It is a business in which he is attaining some level of popularity, but he doesn't really shepherd. So in this study, that's where I have to start. I start in the study itself with the role of the pastor. Now, so if Jim has performed some weddings, I've performed some weddings, the idea is if there comes a distress in the wedding, there is a procedure they are supposed to follow, which is explained in Matthew 18. They follow this procedure with the pastor who performed the wedding having some authority to sit in judgment, and if necessary, the church. So if person A is having a problem with person B, following the Matthew account, they first confront, you know what, there's some things you're doing that are really not right, and I don't know that I can tolerate, this is really bad, and so you have the confrontation. Now, you might have the confrontation once, or you might have it twice, or you might have it 3 or 5 or 10 or 15 times, but you have the confrontation. Now, the second thing is that they are supposed to go and get witnesses and have the confrontation in front of witnesses, which to me, I would think logically it would be, you don't just go get two people, but if we were following law, it would be logical that it would be the best man and the matron of honor who heard the vows, if they're solid Christians. In some cases, that's not possible because a guy picks a best man. This is my friend. I'm going to pick him as my best man. He doesn't know the Lord. He doesn't have any interest in the Lord. So he doesn't even have an honest reason to be there, or the same on the other side. So Christian marriage, when you have Christian marriage, every element of that as we perform it today, which, as I just shared with Jim, the nearest I can find started in 1549, where they actually come and do the service. We're now accepting that. And so these people come, and what we should have is, we should have people who know the law of God, are able to stand and listen, and then in the event of a distress, can be those witnesses that are taken. Unfortunately, in most cases today, that's not the case. And since, as I shared with you last week, Israel was without a teaching priest, since the church has been without a teaching priest, as it were, for so long, we don't know these things. People don't receive them. So that ends up inflicting some pain or some harm upon the people who are entering this life situation because they don't have a way of pursuing a difficulty. What do I do? Well, if they follow Matthew 18, and they may have that confrontation, and then they take the witnesses and they have the confrontation, and there is not a resolution. Now, the next question in my mind is, are they members of the church? If they are members of the church, that means they have agreed to be subject to the government of the church. So now your elders, who are the governing body of the church, are called into this, and they're brought in before the elders, and the elders sit there and go through the process of whatever they do. And if there is a recovery or a healing, fine. If not, the offending party now is facing an excommunication. Now, this is why, you see, this is why Satan has so successfully destroyed the church, the function of the church, and the authority of the church. Doug said to me last night, he said, Dad, he said, it says in Acts 1, 8, he said, you shall receive power after the Holy Spirit has come upon you. He said, Dad, we don't have any power. I said, Dad, you're wrong. I said, we have a lot of power. The church just simply has quit being the church, and so it does not exercise its power and authority as God has ordained it to exercise. And we see, we talk about this a lot. The restoration of church discipline is essential to all of these things. Now, there was, I don't know if you ever saw, I can never remember the name of the movie, but it's a Gary Cooper movie. And I think they're Quakers. Yeah, Friendly Persuasion. And there is this scene in there where these very austere gentlemen come who are from the church, and they're coming to examine Gary Cooper and his family. The wife is a preacher, which is kind of interesting that they have a woman preacher. So they come up there, and they don't believe in instrumental music. And when they're there, they have got an organ, and the organ's upstairs, and the girl and a guy start playing the organ, and Gary Cooper jumps up and starts praying with a very loud voice, and one of the guys that's there to examine says, I thought I heard the angels, or something like that. But the point is, they were there, they came there, and it was fully understood when they were coming, these people were a little bit frightened because they were coming to be examined. So, what began to happen, especially in the mid-1800s with what they call the Second Great Awakening, which was really a second great going to sleep, we began to eliminate the church as a divine institution, and the function of the church began to be eliminated. I was looking at the paper yesterday, and they have this church section, you know, on Saturday always. And they had the picture of this woman who is going to be speaking somewhere or other. And in mentioning her, it said she was a licensed professional counselor. And I thought, that means she's a secular humanist. And then it said she was going to be doing pastoral counseling. So she is a licensed professional counselor. Well, what is the pastor? He is ordained by God. He is, if you want to use the word professional, you can throw it in there, but he is a counselor. That's everything that happens here on Sunday morning in the 11 o'clock hour is Jim counseling. Now, we call it preaching. It's in the form of preaching. But when he starts off frequently, almost without exception, he starts off with a question. Here's a question. Do you ever, have you ever, whatever? And the question is now going to be answered from a biblical perspective so that if the person says, yes, I have done that or whatever, they're now going to hear how they're supposed to handle it. So it's a counseling session. Preaching is counseling. Teaching is counseling. That's what we're supposed to do. And that's the function of the church. The church is the pillar and ground of truth. So we have allowed, by God, it's actually by divine decree, I understand that. But this has happened where now the church has been made to be basically meaningless. So whether it's child training or whether it's family or marriage or whether it's some other thing, doctrine, whatever, the church has been pushed out. So the result is you have these difficulties. Where do I go to resolve it? Well, the scripture gives us a way to do it. Now, so my first position is to establish the role of the pastor. Now I get into the explanation of marriage. And first of all, of course, I go into the Genesis account where God performs the first wedding, as it were, with Adam and Eve, and marriage is established. And it makes it clear that she is going to be bone of his bones and flesh of his flesh, etc. That Christ later on says these two shall be one covenantally. So I said marriage is, this is the first key point. Marriage is a voluntary union. Now, if there's some guy standing there with a shotgun in his hand, and he's saying to one of the other two, you're either going to get married or I'm going to shoot you, that is not a voluntary union. That is a coercion. If one person coerces the other person so that they break down their will, that's not a voluntary union. It is voluntary to a degree, but it is possible for one person to flatter the other person or to use some gimmick in which they cause the other person to submit to something maybe they really didn't want to do in the first place. But later on, when you question them and you say, are you here? Is this a free moral act on your part? And they say yes. Well, only examination could determine whether anything has gone on that would say it is not a voluntary union. So it's supposed to be a voluntary union. Voluntary means simply that. There is no coercion. So this is of a right man and a right woman. This is, again, I've been through this with my class now 3 times this year. They have a tendency to sit there and look and listen, but not listen. And I'm telling them, look, you guys are 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 years old. And there is a possibility, at least, that somewhere down the road you're going to marry. And so I have told them, as I did when I went through this, that the way they are supposed to live their life as a Christian is they are supposed to live it in worship of Jesus Christ with their entire focus on loving the Lord with their heart, soul, mind, and resting in that if it is his will that they marry, he will, in his time, bring the person whom they are to marry into their life. And that there is an orderly establishment. He brings that person in normally as they are an acquaintance. It's somebody we meet, it's somebody we know, we don't really know a whole lot about them, but we know them, say, hey, hi, how you doing, all that sort of thing. And in the process of time, this acquaintanceship, they begin to learn things about each other. And the primary thing that should be learned is, since this is the biblical rule, that God said, it is not good that man should be alone, so I will give him a suitable helper. I'm going to give him an aid. And this woman is going to be a person who assists him in his calling. So Adam had a calling. His calling, he had to prove himself in the calling. He had to name the animals, he had to till the ground, he had to protect the garden, and when he had shown himself to be qualified, we might say, reliable, dependable in his work, somebody who was faithful in that, God said, now I'm going to give you a wife. And so he brings Eve in and performs the union and establishes this right man, right woman. Well, the process that happens so much in today's world with young people is there is attraction that is not, doesn't work, it's not God working in it. God is not bringing them into a holy union. These people are being brought together by something physical or something emotional or whatever it might be. So it is not the order that God intended. And instead of coming together in an acquaintanceship that gradually grows into a friendship, and then the learning of the similar calling and so forth, then that grows into the point of what we call love. And love is, this is not an emotional thing. This is a factual thing, that they have the interest, the full interest in the welfare of the other person. And that finally comes to the point where there is this union. So this, in God's order of marriage, you have this man and this woman. In Christian marriage, you have this man and this woman who have had their lives, they have grown up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, and that is the first focus, and that's what brings them together. And then they come together to act in harmony. Amos said, can two walk together except they be agreed? Well, again, if you don't have a, quote, teaching priest, end quote, who is teaching you the law of the Lord through your life, whether it's dad or whether it's the pastor, or you don't have a teaching priest, you don't know what to be in agreement on. So when Paul writes and says, do not be unequally yoked, there's a danger that people are going to be unequally yoked, especially in spiritual matters, because they have no clear understanding of what it means to be a Christian. They don't have a clear understanding of worship, what is worship, and they don't have an understanding of discipleship and service. So having been denied that, they now are subjected to kind of the Hollywood concept. And they come together in a manner that is not necessarily intended by God. But this is the way, it's a voluntary union of these two people who act in harmony, using their individual skills. God fits them together. See, she is supposed to be a suitable helper. And, of course, if you read Proverbs 31 and you see this virtuous woman and you see everything that she does, you have one little comment in there about her husband. It says he's known in the gates, which means that he probably has some a political clout. He's probably part of the governing of the town, and he has a popularity which is directly related to her. How she has conducted herself elevates him, and the people see him that way, and maybe a little bit of envy there about the quality of his wife. So they use individual skills by which they retain their identity and determine the contribution each is going to make. Ephesians 4:15 and 16 says, speaking the truth in love, that they may grow up into him, in all things, which is the head, even Christ, from whom the whole body, fitly joined together and compacted by that which every joint supplies, according to the effectual working in the measure of every part, makes the increase of the body unto the edifying of itself in love. Now, that's talking about the body, but that is a suitable scripture for marriage. See, speaking the truth in love, they have to be able to do that. Grow up into him in all things, from whom they supply to the body that which God has given them. And now you have this true union. And this is an essential thing. And then I said, fourthly, that this is to reach a common goal. Again, we have an ideal. If we take the ideal, if we take the time, and God gives us the audience, and we have the opportunity to teach these little tiny children in that which they have to know. I said to Billy and Braden and Andrew and Joey, we're sitting up here, and Jacob. And I said to them the other morning, I said, how old are you? Billy, how old are you?
Four.
You're four. How old was Braden?
I'm five.
Five. How old was Andrew?
Five.
And how old was Jacob?
Six.
Six. And I said, look, boys, you boys are going to become men. And it is the plan of God that you become men of God. That when Billy becomes, ideally, if I took an ideal age, I would say, when Billy becomes 12, using the Jewish manner of working, when Billy becomes 12, he would be bar mitzvahed. He would become a son of the commandment. In our view, when Billy becomes 12, he is going to become knowledgeable, not only in Reformed doctrine, but he's going to become knowledgeable in how a young man is supposed to serve the Lord. So that at the age of 12, he is going to have a very high level of maturity. And he's going to be able even to teach others because of this upbringing. Now, in the Proverbs, it tells the young man that he is to keep the commandments of his father and his mother. Sometimes in these situations, you have a woman who is predominant in the desire to train her children. Sometimes you have a man who is predominant, and sometimes you have both of them in agreement. In any event, if there's a common goal, this has to be established beforehand. And when the goal is established, that means they've sat down and discussed, as Christian people. Now, remember, we're talking Christian marriage. That beforehand, they sat down and discussed the goals they have for this family they are establishing. Should we have children? What are we going to do with these children? How are we going to raise them? What kind of discipline are we going to use? What do we want them to be as they're growing? What do we expect to establish as a lasting testimony? Now, because we have separated back in the mid-1800s, because men like Finney and others of his ilk came along, and they started this whole new way of doing things, and now teaching the law of God, teaching the catechism, teaching the things, just kind of got dumped. By the time you get up to where we are now, you basically have nothing being established in the young people that is going to prepare them for the usefulness in their future stations. And that's our fourth point on education, to fit them for usefulness in their future stations. So what Jennifer, in her heart, she looks at her son and she says, I want him to be a, you can just say it this way, I want him to be a man of God. That's kind of a lost term. But if he's a man of God, that means he's a godly man. And he's going to be established in the Word. He's going to know the Scripture. All right? Debbie and Robin have this year been teaching their children to learn to memorize the books of the Bible. They got the whole Bible now, right? Yeah, because the other morning I had them go through it, and they pretty much have the whole thing memorized. Well, that what that does is that makes it possible for them, if I say, hey, I want you to open to Ezekiel this morning. They can take their Bible. They know pretty much where to look. I've got other kids that are sitting there saying, where in the world do I go? Most of the kids in my learning center can turn right to it, thank the Lord. They can go right there and look and read, and then I have them read it. But there's to be a common goal. Now, the goal of marriage can be summed up in what the Shorter Catechism says is the chief end of man: to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. All right? Now, again, we've been so far away from this, we don't connect that sort of thing to these details of life, of which marriage is one. So it is to be to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. Thus, we could say that marriage consists of two people pulling a common load under the direction of a consistent and unbiased governing authority, which is the Scripture. See, this is the law of the Lord. So this is what they're doing. They're studying the Word and then applying the Word in their personal lives and in the training of their family. So you have two people pulling a common load under the direction of a consistent and unbiased governing authority in which they are seeking to glorify God and enjoy Him. Basically, that's it. Now, if we go back just for a second, voluntary union. Voluntary, I've already talked about. Voluntary means when that person, and when I perform a wedding, normally what I do is I publicly ask the question first, are you a Christian? And they'll say to me, yes, I am a Christian. That was decided in the class. My second thing is, are you here of a free will? And they say, yes, I'm here of a free will. If they're there of a free will, you see, that means that what they're going to do, what they're going to say at that point is not being forced on them, which makes them accountable for what they're saying in front of witnesses. So it is done from the free will of the person, and because it is a covenant entered into voluntarily, the right of complaint is basically removed, not entirely removed, because of the fact of covenantal death. One person can die covenantally. They take the vows, they go through all the motions, but now they're in the marriage. The marriage might have been for them a conquest as opposed to a union. They come into this marriage, and it's very possible for that person to begin to violate all of the terms of the covenant, and they become covenantally dead. That's what happened to Adam and Eve. Look, guys, I'm going to give you the garden. I'm going to give you the trees of the garden. You're going to have a great time in here, so long as you don't eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And one day, old Satan comes along and he says, hey, eat it. Ain't no big deal. God knows that if you eat it, you'll be like God. You can have all kind of authority and power to decide right and wrong. And he gives her the bill of goods. And so they eat. They became covenantally dead. And therefore, they had to be expelled from the garden. And the reason is, beyond that, you cannot bring a third person into the covenant. So these two come together. Jesus said, the two shall be one. You can't bring a third one into the covenant. And Satan tried to get into the covenant. See, well, I'll just go be part of it. So when these two come together, you have some rules here. You've got some standards about this third, whatever that third thing is. It doesn't even have to be a person. It can be an idea. It can be an activity. It can be something which tries to make a third-party covenant, which is illegal, and draws that person into the state of becoming dead, in which case the covenant ceases. Jim made the comment over at Men's Breakfast, I think it was, that God divorced Israel. See, God divorced Israel, okay? So if there is not a common goal, then you're going to end up having a problem, though, even though it's voluntary, you might not have a union. It's a voluntary union. This is tricky. And this is where the church, at some point, the church has to get involved, because the church is the one that brought these people together in law, and the church is supposed to sit in judgment, and we've kind of thrown that out, if it comes to that point. And discipline then is carried out in the proper order. Okay, my time is up, so I have to stop there.